Nerdology is now presented by Sardine, and I couldn't be more excited. You'll get to meet their founder, Supes, and some of the team later this quarter, and you'll hear a bit more about why they've caught the attention of some of the smartest fraud leaders I know throughout crypto, fintech, financial services, and e-commerce. Thanks again to Sardine for supporting this episode of Fraudology. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Fraudology Podcast, where we dive into the science and study of online fraud from the perspective of an e-commerce fraud fighter. I'm Carice Hendrick. Well, another MRC conference is in the books. If you have been listening to the podcast for a few years, or just if you caught the episode a couple of weeks ago with a few members of the Merchant Risk Council, you know that last week I was in Las Vegas, and that's probably why my voice sounds a little different. Even though it's been a few days since I got back, I talked a lot while I was there. I'm sure that doesn't surprise anyone that listens to this podcast, but it's always so great to meet up with 1,800 of your closest fraud fighting friends. I wouldn't pretend to know more than half of them, but it was a really great week. And I know that some of you had severe FOMO and you were missed for sure. I wish this was an event that everyone could go to. Maybe one day we will have a Fraudology conference, whether it's a part of the MRC or something different, and hopefully you all could come to that. But I know it's not an event that everyone gets to go to, and so I'm going to try my best to give a recap of that today. It is hard because I'm just one person with, you know, my own experiences, but I certainly can provide some of the highlights that I and things that I noticed about the conference and the expo hall and just the conversations that were being had, and hope that that helps fill you in. And even if you did attend last week, I'm sure you didn't have the same experience I did. So I'd love to hear, you know, what was different and what you took away from the event last week. So as a reminder of what the MRC is, it stands for the Merchant Risk Council. They are a trade association in the e-commerce fraud space. There definitely are companies that attend that are more on the fintech side, whether it's consumer lending or consumer banking. There are a couple of issuing banks that attend and a few banks, the traditional banks that attend as well. But for the most part, most of it is e-commerce fraud prevention. I have said this before, so I'm sure it's a repeat to everyone, but I attended my first Merchant Risk Council conference in 2009 when there were 250 attendees and I was overwhelmed by them all. And I believe there were less than 20 women at the time. And now, just this last year, they had more people than ever at 1,800. And I would say, just by eyeballing it, probably 30 to 40% of the attendees were women. It's not just e-commerce merchants that attend, as well as fintechs and banks. It's also the solution provider side. It's about 50-50 when you factor in all of the companies that are exhibiting in the expo hall, as well as, you know, companies that are wanting to learn more about the space or make connections without having a booth. So we had both sides of the event attending. This is an event I realized, even though I haven't gone every year, I have been going since 2009, but I realized that this year was my 10th MRC conference in Vegas. They also have some much smaller events in the fall, and they have a spring event in Europe as well. Their spring event will be, I believe, the beginning of May in Barcelona. If you are in Europe and you're able to attend, I highly recommend it. It'll be a smaller group, but I always learned so much when I got to attend European MRC events, even more than I learned in the US. So it's a real good event to attend if you can. People come internationally to MRC Vegas because it is the biggest and because, you know, there's the most fraud in North America when it comes to e-commerce. So there are a lot of international companies that have a presence in the US, and so they'll, you know, attend the Vegas conference as well. I am still exhausted. I was there for 5 days, although the conference is technically six, but although the conference is four, it starts on Monday with some training sessions and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday with conference sessions. And every night is full of something. I tried to be good, although Sardine sponsored an a Fraudology event, and Sardine is also the sponsor of the podcast this quarter on Tuesday night, and that was really fun. We had well over 100 Fraudology listeners attend the event behind a speakeasy, or within a speakeasy. So you walk up to this place that looks like a pawn shop, and behind it, you go through this, you know, unassuming door, and behind it is a restaurant. So that was really fun and was so good to see so many of you there. But overall, it was just a lot of late nights and early mornings and lots of talking, as I said. My favorite part about this conference, more than any other conference that I've gone to over the years, is just how many familiar faces I get to see. Some people that I've known for well over a decade. You know, I've known them before they had kids or before they, you know, got married or had significant life events. They've known me since my daughter was in kindergarten, and now she's almost 20. There's something familiar in that. And also, I think that there is something to be said for the fact that so many people who fight fraud, we have similarities in our interests, in how our brain works, in the things that we enjoy talking about. And so it's always nice to get to be surrounded by those people, whether you've known them for a decade or not, and just have community. I think it's super important. Oftentimes, it's easy to feel like you're the only person within your company that cares about these things. And a lot of times, it's helpful to go to a conference and see, oh, I'm not the only one. In fact, there's a lot of us. I also got to meet a lot of new people, and that's always so much fun, too. I will never stop being humbled by how many people listen to the podcast, how many people introduce themselves to me that I'm like, oh my gosh, you listen? That's great. And to the two listeners who asked for my autograph and came prepared with a marker and a Fraud Squad hat from Sardine, you both made my day. That was hilarious. It was very kind of them. I've been asked for my autograph, I think just jokingly before in the past. You know, I certainly don't think I'm a big deal. I just talk into a microphone often in my sweatpants and hope the people listen to it. But I have been asked for my autograph in the past. But like I said, I think it was just a joke. And I've always joked about identity fraud. So that way I'm like, oh, what? So you can steal my signature? No. But in this case, they came prepared and it was very sweet. They were asking for it for a member of their team. They were only able to send two people and they have a team of three. And so it was really important to them that they get something signed by me to give to their colleague who's a big listener. So I hope that they're listening to that now and know that it also made my day. I texted my daughter and said, I just gave my first autograph. That was weird, but fun. They not only came prepared with a marker and a hat, but I noticed one of them taking pictures of me signing the hat for authenticity. And that is one of one. So the person who ended up with that is a special edition. You guys just can't, I can't overstate just how wild this ride has been since starting the podcast and just how funny it is sometimes to me. I joke with my friends back home that the week of MRC is the only week a year that I feel like the most popular girl in school. And it's just so fun to get to hear what people's favorite episodes were, what has really resounded with you, or what, you know, you remember, you know, what takeaways you have from the podcast. Those are questions I love to ask because it helps me know what content to do. Sometimes I'm not always sure. And I enjoy hearing from you, whether it's, you know, via LinkedIn message or it's in person at a conference. It's just, it really makes my day. And it helps encourage me to keep going because I just, like with anything, there are days when you're like, I don't know what the point of this is, or is anyone going to listen? Or is anyone going to pay attention? And so, you know, those little bits of encouragement do help. And I try to remember them on those days when I'm like, oh, is anyone listening? Or does this matter? And that does help me just to keep going. So I appreciate it. There's also just something about the excitement of a fraud fighter, whether it's the first event or their, you know, 10th or 11th. There's something about how much we enjoy what we do. I don't think that's common for most industries. I don't think it's common for most industries to feel like a small industry where so many people know each other. I don't think it's common for those of us to feel like this isn't just a job, but it's a passion. There were multiple times when either there were cocktails around and it was late at night, or it was early in the morning over coffee and people were just standing in the hallway, that I'd walk by conversations and I'd hear people just talking about in the depths of fraud, right? Or payments as well, and talking about different things. And it just struck me as, I don't think that happens at every work conference. I mean, my husband has gone to a few conferences for his line of work, and I don't think those same conversations are being had. At least it doesn't seem like it from what he says. People aren't saying, hey, you know, let's dive into multinational fraud and talk about, you know, this tactic versus that tactic versus, you know, credential stuffing ATOs versus brute force ATOs and how, you know, they're different and just all these different intricacies that you can talk about, or asking, well, how does your company do this or this? Those are just normal conversations that people would be having, whether it was 1 a.m. or 10 a.m. And that's, you know, shows our passion and shows that there's just something unique about this industry that I don't know many other industries that are similar. And again, I don't know any other industry as much as I know this one, but I certainly have friends in other industries that kind of look at me like, wow, you really like what you do. And wow, people really, they actually like to listen to a podcast about what they do in their free time. I'm like, yep, I know. And we love it. I wish I could share more about some of the specific conversations that I had. I always promise anonymity, but I can tell that there are some companies doing really cool things with the unique data they have access to. And it's to better understand the fraud that targets them. Whether that's in the telco level, the retail level, on the banking side, just seems like, you know, data and understanding good users and bad users to a level that we've never been able to see them before is becoming very commonplace. And it's my hope, you know, through this podcast and through other things as well, that some cross-pollination of that information can happen. That will most likely be offline in the member group that is coming up soon. I know that I had said it would be ready in March. That did not happen, but I will be able to announce it soon-ish, by May at the very latest. But there will just be some things that we can't talk about on a public podcast, but certainly in a private forum that is well vetted and where people have to apply to become members, there are conversations that can be had, and that cross-pollinating of information from telco to retail or retail to gaming or gaming to travel, etc., I just think is so valuable because every vertical has experienced the same type of fraud, but at different times, and they have different types of data and different types of tools. And so there's a lot that you can learn from each other that I think is just very important to share. On the technology side, on the vendor side, there definitely were several observations that I made and that other people made as well, primarily on the expo hall floor. It was bigger than it's ever been, at least to my knowledge. Not all the vendors had booths. There were some that, you know, were wandering the floor, but many of them did. And that's, you know, kind of the easiest way to identify them. There are some really interesting and new technology that seems promising. There are others that maybe don't seem as promising or seem as new, but that's, you know, the thing about capitalism, right? Like, hopefully the market will speak and say, you know, which products are most helpful and which ones may not be. A few of the other observations, and this is kind of on that note, is that some of the companies that had huge booths just a couple of years ago were much smaller now. And other booths that were small, you know, when they first started are now big. So they start out with a 10 by 10 and maybe now they have a 40 by 40 or a 20 by 10. And, you know, it's not the booth size that matters, but it certainly does draw attention the bigger the booth is. And so you can kind of see, oh, wow, this one company, you know, really had a lot of budget to put towards this and thought it was very important and spent a lot of money on this conference, you know, just 2 years ago. And now they're there, but they're not there in its full force. Or maybe it's that their product wasn't as successful as they assumed it would be. And then vice versa also happened. There were companies that first came a couple years ago and were really small and now are doing really well and have a big blueprint. You know, it's hard to explain all of the events that happen after hours or off campus, but everything from, you know, driving NASCAR cars to tours of the Sphere in Las Vegas. One year I got to go on a helicopter, thanks to a vendor, over the Las Vegas Strip. Lots of dinners were happening. It's just, there's so many things that happen simultaneously, and we talked about this a little bit on the previous episode with the members, where you just have to understand that you can't do everything and see everything, but it's really hard because you want to. At the same time, I don't think I could have fit another day in without, you know, just really being even more exhausted than I already have been. One note for those of you on the vendor side, if, you know, you're frustrated that you're hearing, that you're not hearing back from prospects, whether it was before the conference or after, I hope that you realize that everyone's reaching out to the same companies. And not all merchants need new products. I think that's something that's often misunderstood. There are some, you know, retailers or companies in general that are doing well with what they have, or they just don't have the budget or the engineering resources to implement something new. Or maybe, yeah, implementing something new would give them incremental improvement, but is that enough improvement to justify a whole new contract and a whole new product implementation? So I know that's difficult and challenging for salespeople to hear, but I do think it's important to note that you're not the only person reaching out, and this is not anyone's full-time job. In fact, most of the time in job descriptions for fraud leadership, going back and forth or responding to prospective solution provider emails is not even in their job description. So that doesn't mean that, you know, they get off the hook for just ignoring you. But I do think it's important to realize that in some cases, especially for the bigger companies, if somebody replied back to every email they got from someone, they wouldn't be able to do their regular job. Whether that's right or wrong, I mean, that's another topic. But I just think it helps to put yourself in the other side's shoes sometimes and realize, okay, this probably isn't personal. I know that that's a frustration that's often had on the solution provider side. So I wanted to make sure that I, you know, mentioned that to you, that it's not personal, but it's just, it's the way it is. There are so many new companies coming out in addition to existing companies, and everyone's reaching out to the same, you know, top 300 or top 400 companies. Those companies can only respond to so many.
Every one of your users has different motivations to be on your website. Some want to buy today, and others just want to browse your products and services for now. Some will become your biggest customers, while others, who might appear very similar, will try to steal as much as they can from your company before you identify them. Spec recognizes that not every user on your website is the same, and that's why they want to help you orchestrate your customer journeys based on each customer's purpose and motivations, all without any internal engineering resources or APIs. Spec allows you to learn so much more about the unique customer journeys on your website and design different paths with more or less verification based on those journeys, all without requiring you to change your current fraud or identity vendors and without any code on your end. I know those of us in fraud are trained to believe that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But when it comes to Spec, that belief doesn't apply. So visit www.specprotected.com, that's S-P-E-C protected.com, to learn more about their Trust Cloud or to schedule your customized demo soon.
As far as the sessions at MRC, there were two that I thought that I would highlight. There's only, I mean, I think there were 45 sessions, maybe more than that. And so I certainly couldn't attend all of them. I think there were four to five at a time. And truthfully, I had a few meetings during some of them too. But there were two that I attended on the first day that I thought were worth talking about a bit on the podcast. And they are specific to e-commerce fraud. That doesn't mean that if you're not in e-commerce fraud, that you should stop listening, but just letting you guys know that. One is around 8-digit BIN numbers. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, a BIN number has traditionally, up until the last year or two, been the first 6 digits of a credit card. Those first 6 digits can tell a lot about the credit card itself. It tells which bank it's a part of. It also tells if it's a debit or a credit card, if it's a commercial card or a consumer card, different things like that. Well, because there are so many different issuing banks, oh, there's also prepaid cards too that use BINs. So both for Visa, MasterCard, and then also Discover and Amex. So we know that Visa starts with 4. So all 6 digits that are Visa cards would all start with 4. MasterCard starts with 5, Discover with 6, and Amex with 3. And then the following 5 letters would, or 5 numbers would be really
tell you about the specific bank. There's a lot of things that online companies use BIN numbers for, both on the payment side and on the fraud side. And I'm not going to go into every single use case, but on the payment side, it would be helpful to know, is there one specific bank that is declining all of our transactions? Is there one specific bank that is having difficulty approving transactions? What are those, you know, banking codes and the interchange pricing? Even though you can't do anything about that, you can't restrict cards based on how much it costs to process them. It can be helpful information for routing purposes and other. And then on the fraud side, it's really important because fraudsters care about BINs. They know that they want to use those high dollar BINs, the BINs that might come with, you know, a personal shopper or a private jet program, because those BINs probably won't have limits. Or if they do, they'll be very, very high. There's also fraudsters often purchase credit cards in BIN lists. So they'll purchase, you know, 100 or thousands of card numbers by BIN. So it might be, oh, they're all from this specific bank, or there's a big chunk of them that are from a specific bank. So if all of a sudden you see a spike in BIN number, in a specific BIN number coming through as fraud transactions, well, then you can think, okay, we might need to consider cards on this BIN a little more high risk for right now. There's various different use cases. Those are just a couple of them. BIN has always been so important, and that's why you've been able to see first six and last four for PCI purposes. You know, most companies can't see the full PAN or the full 16 digits, but they can see the first six so they can identify the bank and then the last four. And those are going to be unique to the bank. Well, the challenge came several years ago. I remember it first being talked about prior to COVID. So 5 years ago or so, talking about, hey, we're, you know, banks are going to have to, well, at least Visa, MasterCard, are going to have to go to 8-digit BINs because there's just so many issuing banks. And within all those issuing banks, there's different types of cards, right? So you might have one bank that has several different types of debit cards and several different types of credit cards, depending on risk or depending on credit report or, you know, different things like that. And then you've got international cards that are all underneath those BINs too. And so knowing that it had to be a 6-digit, you know, number that started with a 4 or a 5, that then limits it only to 5 digits, and they were running out. So Visa and MasterCard have been transitioning to 8-digit BINs, but there's been a lot of questions on them, especially how do we know which BINs are 6 and which BINs are 8? Because if you look up a BIN by 6 digits, you're not going to actually get the right bank, especially if it's really an 8-digit number. But then there's complexities with PCI because PCI requires only the first 6, not the first 8. So how do you look up the BIN? There's so many different questions around it. And so there was a really good panel that was moderated by a company called Pagos that is more on the payment side. And then they had representatives from GoDaddy, Uber, and StubHub all talking about this. And they were talking about the payments and the fraud implications. And one of the stats that I thought was really important, I took a picture of the slide because I wanted to make sure I got these numbers correct, is that as of right now, 13.5% of all Visa cards and 71% of all MasterCards have transitioned to 8-digit BINs. And I know there's been issues with a couple of my clients reaching out over the last few months saying, hey, I looked up this BIN and usually it's just in Google or something like that, and it doesn't make any sense. And I've said, well, do you know if it's an 8-digit BIN? Well, how do I know if it's an 8-digit BIN? And it sounds like you really are only going to know if you have a BIN provider. And those are controversial in some ways. This is something that's been frustrating to me on the e-commerce side for a long time, is that fraudsters have compiled BIN lists. They honestly, on the dark web or in Telegram groups, they have the best BIN lists. I remember one client asking me if I could purchase a BIN list for them on the dark web. And I said, well, I couldn't, but I, you know, probably know someone that could. But then they asked if I could get them a receipt. And I remember saying, the dark web doesn't give receipts. It wouldn't be tax deductible. It wouldn't be expensible. I don't think the IRS would recognize that, at least in the US. But I don't know about tax laws anywhere else, but I doubt that that would be a case anywhere. But the frustration is that there really aren't BIN lists on the good side. There aren't directories that you can purchase or that you can use. There are a couple of payments companies that when they process your transactions, they can provide you with what bank and the banking information of that bin when they process the transaction. But there isn't actually a bin Bible, so to speak, or a bin directory that can be purchased or even accessed, not from Visa, MasterCard. And it, you know, historically, they've never wanted merchants to have access to it. And what I was always told was because they didn't want merchants to be able to identify which cards would be more expensive to process. Because, and I think I talked about this before when I kind of went into payments in an episode or two, but on the payment side, the interchange, the fee that is assessed to online merchants to for the privilege of processing credit cards, it varies based on several factors. Sometimes it's based on how you're processing the transactions, how much data you're accumulating and providing through the payment process and through the ecosystem, you know, through that lifecycle. Others are based on the card type. For instance, I think the easiest one to remember is any card that has rewards points on it is generally going to have a high interchange rate because in theory, merchants are actually paying for those points or those rewards miles. Not outright, but they're paying a higher fee for rewards cards. But knowing that consumers purchase more when there's a reward component, companies find that valuable. So I actually don't think that if a bin directory was ever released, that companies would say, okay, we're just going to block these bins because they're expensive. I could be wrong, but in my opinion, the fraud use cases and options far outweigh any risks about blocking them. And I certainly think that if a specific merchant was blocking specific bin numbers, that Visa and MasterCard could track those pretty quickly. So that's something that I will continue to advocate for, especially with 8-digit bins. It makes it 100 times more complicated. And it is really important to know, you know, patterns on bin numbers that can be very helpful for fraud. So in this session, they talked about some of those challenges, but then also why, you know, these identifiers and lists are critical. In some cases, there's a 6-digit bin number that would be a Discover card in the US, but in Turkey, in the country of Turkey, it would be one of their credit cards. And so there's a lot of overlap too. And so trying to figure that out, or how do you know if something's a 6 or an 8-digit? Well, you know, that really depends on if you have access to a bin list, if you have access to a provider that provides that information and that can tell you automatically, this is this bank and this is that bank. And they have a list internally of the ones that are 8 and 6. That's really the only way you can tell now. And that makes it really challenging. The other topic that the other session that I thought was worth highlighting in this episode is the one on refund fraud. That's a topic that I've been talking about on the podcast for almost 4 years now, since the beginning of Fraudology. And that's because I was fortunate to be on the cutting edge of it and find out that this was fraud and not just abuse early in 2020, working with several dozen online merchants, you know, with very big brands who were all saying, this seems like it's more than just a coincidence. And we realized over time that this is systematic, intentional fraud. This is not customer abuse. And really, it's fraud committed at the refund claims level, because people are receiving items, but then claiming they didn't get them, or claiming that, you know, they ordered 2 items and only one item came. And of course, the one item that came is the cheaper one. Or the other very popular method is what the fraudsters refer to as FTID, or fake tracking ID. There are several different methods of this, but the basic premise is that the customer makes it look like they returned the item to a retailer's warehouse, but in reality, they didn't. They kept it. But they're calling customer service saying, hey, here's my tracking number for the thing that I returned. I need my money back. And they're taking advantage of several different silos within a retailer's environment that, you know, the warehouse systems don't talk to the CRM most of the time. And you can't search a CRM, but for tracking number, because those are reissued every 90 days. And so you can't, that's not a searchable field. And so they're taking advantage of that as well. They're taking off any identifiable information on that postage stamp or on that label. They're returning the box with something else in it, whether it's garbage, it's a can of peas, it's dry ice to match that weight of what was sent to them. Just depending on what bar they have to reach, they'll do it. And then when the warehouse gets it, they can't attribute that empty mailer or envelope or, you know, box of garbage or, you know, little army men or pinata candy or whatever it is. They can't attribute that to a customer because they can't look it up by tracking number. So instead, the warehouse just throws it away. So when someone calls customer service, there's no way to tie that together. So someone looks up their account number, then they go in and look at the tracking and it says, oh, that package was delivered back to us. It doesn't show if, you know, and if the item wasn't checked in, well, that wouldn't be the customer's fault if it were true, if that was actually what happened, if the warehouse wasn't able to check that in a timely manner. And so that's when a refund is issued. But as I've mentioned on previous episodes, and especially on the ones with Diana Gajek-Fizik, who used to run the fraud department for Finish Line and JD Sports, we talked about 6 months ago or so about how she and I, you know, helped discover this type of fraud and what how it works and what it is and all of that really in depth. I know I've talked about it in other episodes too. But Diana was the speaker for this session, as well as someone from Assertify. And they dove into, you know, the different types of refund fraud. And then Diana gave a few practical examples of infrastructure to put in place and ways of identifying refund fraud versus abuse. Those are things that she and I both are really aligned on as far as what those are, but they aren't things that I can share on a public podcast. We've got to try to keep something secret. But it was a really good session. It was standing room only, not surprisingly, mostly with retailers in the audience. And what was more clear than ever is that this type of fraud that used to only impact the biggest retailers in the US has expanded. It's expanded its reach, you know, throughout North America, not just in the US, and then a few parts of the UK and the EU, and to companies that aren't as well known or, you know, that are specialty stores. And you can see that on Telegram groups and Discord groups as well, is that a lot of times they're now targeting specialty stores rather than the biggest stores, because the biggest stores have put things in place to identify this type of fraud, or at least make it more difficult to commit. But it just, this session just reminded me as well that this type of fraud isn't going away. There's a strong need for the right solution. And there are, you know, one or two that I'm aware of that I think are addressing the issues holistically. But there are several others that are claiming to do so that aren't. So I think it's important to do your homework and to understand the problem so that you know if a specific solution will help solve it or not. But it was very good conversation, very good session. The audience was very engaged, and it just helped remind me that this is sometimes like when I feel like I've talked about a type of fraud a lot, I just kind of stop talking about it. But what it reminded me of was that this is really important, and this is a type of fraud that every company in retail is seeing, as well as some delivery drivers and some delivery companies, whether it be, you know, of food or groceries or, you know, delivering anything these days, because people can say, oh, I didn't get it, or I did get it, but there was something wrong with one of the products, and then they can try to get their whole, you know, purchase back. So I wanted to highlight that one because it was very clear to me that it's not going anywhere and that it still remains to be a pretty big problem. Well, that's going to be it for me today. I hope you enjoyed this recap of the MRC Conference 2024. If you attended and there was anything I missed, please let me know. If you didn't get to attend this year, start making that business case now. We'd love to see you. I would love to see you. I love getting to know listeners of the podcast. And it's a good organization to get involved with as well. With that, I'm going to let you go until later this week when I'll have another episode, and I'll talk to you then.
The
thank you again to Sardine for sponsoring this episode of Fraudology and for supporting information sharing and collaboration across the FraudFighter ecosystem. You can learn more about the team and their mission at Sardine via the link in today's episode description.